the end of the matter all... No, start again. The end of the matter, one all understands, all man's to fear God and to keep his commands. For God judges works with what all is concealed, what's good and what's evil, all will be revealed. Yeah. For example, I just found out, I believe the leather in my leather jacket that I bought is fake. And the final way that I assess that, even though it's got many indications it could be real by many of the standard tests, like the heat test and all that, but scratching it, it doesn't scratch like leather would. When you scratch real leather, it doesn't look real. It's too uniform in places where it shouldn't be, in ways it shouldn't be. But anyway, the thing is, I've more or less decided I'm going to get a real leather jacket. And, you know, what I will do with the fake one, I don't know, but I'm not going to return it. I'm just going to learn a lesson. It's better to learn from your mistakes. I've got fake leather belts, too, that were called genuine leather. So the fact they called this real leather, and they even said it was real lambskin, and they compared it to, you know, if it's real lambskin, why can't I scratch it with my fingernail and make a mark on it? It can't be real lambskin. I can't make a mark with my fingernail. Surely real skin is softer than my nail. So I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe it's real. But another thing that this applies to is, you know how these large CCD arrays used in digital cameras are supposed to be so much, you know, better because they have more megapixels and all that? Well, the truth is, every transistor required, or every employed, that is, every transistor in a digital array requires a drain current going through it, requires a small amount of current. And they have a minimum amount of current required for each transistor. So the more megapixels, the more of this noise flowing through, which is the drain current. It just appears as noise on the video or the final output of the camera, which is either a photo or a video. So you get noise, and that noise is just because of the required background, you know, what you call that, the base level current required, or the drain current. It's the voltage that's required, right, to enable it to work. But because there's a voltage, there will be a slight drain current through each transistor. And because they can't minimize that enough, they can't make it zero. So when you have more megapixels, you end up with this huge amount of noise. So these large arrays, where they're really large numbers of pixels, are very poor in low light. That's the reality, okay? A lot of noise. And that's why you get no contrast at all with those in low light. Okay, so you gotta, if you want good low light performance, use a smaller array. Use a 12 megapixel or 8 megapixel or 4 megapixel camera, you know? Excuse me. Make do with less. With fewer megapixels. Much better in low light. That's why the iPhone 6S camera that I'm using, I'm using the selfie camera, far better in low light, because it's probably only 4 megapixels. Okay, whatever. I'm not even sure what it is. It's very low resolution and very, very good sensitivity in low light, or high, you know, high contrast compared to other cameras with more megapixels. So don't increase your megapixels unless you're going to be taking pictures in bright sunlight. That's the lesson. Now, In the Ark of Burart to the Orient Express, Chapter 3, Paragraph 5, our study for today. One thing about wood, in order to burn, it needs to be dry. Nimrod, Nebrod, or Namurd, has been identified with people of various times, from Narmer in the early days of post-flood Egypt to Enmerkar of Uruk. These first two may be Nimrod, having the NMR of his name, right, to Gilgamesh of Uruk, to the Semite Sargon the Great of Akkad, to Naram-Sin of Akkad, Sargon's grandson. Naram-Sin contains NMR, to Amraphel, who is so identified in the Book of Jasher, to Sharkalishari, the son of Naram-Sin, or Amraphel, to Belus, the Babylonian king or supposed father of Ninus. All of those have been identified as Nimrod. The sons of Ham were Cush, in Hebrew meaning black, and the other sons of Ham, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan, according to the best of authorities, Genesis 10:6. Cush became father to Nimrod from Genesis 10:8. And Moses Corensis states Nimrod is a son of Mizraim. Thus Nimrod is Egyptian, for Mizraim is Egypt in Hebrew. While nothing is certain, Mr. George Smith says Nimrod was called Belus, or quoting Sir William Drummond, quote, among the early descendants of Ham, Nimrod appears to have been one of the most distinguished for his genius, his valor, and his fortune, but the most dreaded for his cruelty and the most hated for his crimes. Known by various titles and denominations to the ancient Orientalists, he was adored by the Chaldeans under the name of Bel, Dominus, and as the image of the sun. And he was called Zohak, the just lord, by his Persian flatterers, while his enemies, by a slight alteration of the sound, converted this laudatory title into a bitter reproach. The chiefs of Iran, whom fortune had made his slaves, denominated the conqueror Namurd, immortal, but the descendants of Shem in the line of Eber appear to have altered this name in derision from Namurd, the immortal. We know some of the sons of Eber stayed in the land of Shinar and lived there until the time of Abraham and so on, to Nimrod the rebel. They altered his name from Namurd to Nimrod, the sons of Shem. And we shall find in another part of this work that Zohak or Dohak was the name given by the Persians not only to Nimrod, but to a long line of Assyrian kings, his successors. That's the end of the quote. So where he says in another part of this work, he's talking about his own work, that is Sir William Drummond's book, Origin of Empires, Volume 1, 1824, that was a quote from page 92. When I clicked on it, here it is. Chapter 10 of Nimrod. So there are yet still quite a few books available for free on places like Google Books, but also archive.org is an excellent resource. Now, in this illustration, we have this picture of the four rivers of Eden, and when we make it a little bigger, we see that the Persian Gulf is very close to where these four rivers come out, but they really are actually flowing in to the Persian Gulf. But in the Bible, it talks about the four heads coming out of the Garden of Eden. Right? Or there were four heads talked about in the book of Genesis in the Garden of Eden, and these are the four, evidently. We've got the Euphrates, the Tigris, the Gihon and the Pishon, which has been found in the desert, which is no longer flowing as a river, but it's been found on satellite imaging, and they've driven, you know, off-road vehicles through there. I've seen videos on the subject of these people who investigate this river through the desert. It's just a dried-up riverbed. But this is therefore indicating that the Garden of Eden was right in this area of Eridu, which is also the basis for the German word Earth in our language, English, but Erde in German, meaning Earth. That's the basis of the meaning of this word Eridu. Evidently, is it means Earth, or it's the first city, in fact, known was Eridu. And you see the difference, the distance from Babylon there. It's not all that terribly far from Babylon, so that, in fact, we've considered at some point during our study, my study personally, that Eridu is the location of the Tower of Babel, actually, not Babylon initially, but Eridu, the first location of the attempted construction of the Tower of Babel, which would make sense because it's in the area of the Garden of Eden. And so when the flood survivors returned from Armenia, where the ark landed, and after they had grown in numbers over many, many decades, when they traveled down south, it would make sense. And it says they journeyed from the east, is what the Bible says, but that's, you know, that's not all that informative as to how they got here, the place from which they came to get to Eridu. But evidently they came down from the north down to this place here and started to build the Tower of Babel, which was in the same place as where the Garden of Eden was originally, which sort of makes a lot of sense if they actually knew where the Garden of Eden had been, which is would be a little bit difficult to say whether or not they would have known that. In the Bible, Genesis 10:10 puts the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom in the land of Shinar at Babel. That's for Nimrod, who lived much later than the Tower of Babel, right? But people think, and many references are confusing the two, Nimrod with the time of the later kingdom of Naram-Sin, or Sargon, the great, the first king of Akkad. The difference is Nimrod was the son of Cush, according to the Bible, but as we're going to read here, the Akkadian Empire, Sargon the Great's empire, was Semite, or from Shem. He was a Semite. Erech was also part of the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom, which is also compared with the name Uruk. Erech and Uruk, evidently the same place. Akkad was the beginning of his kingdom before the Akkadian Empire ever existed, and Kalne, although we don't, yeah, it's interesting, Akkad, Kalne, so from Genesis 10:10, so the Akkadian, the city of Akkad, from this then, existed long before the Akkadian Empire, and Kalne, hundreds of years before, and Kalne, furthermore, meaning these cities, Assyrian cities of Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Calais, and Rezin, as later, it names them, as later cities. We are, in that's Genesis 10:10. We are principally interested in God's word, but there are many traditions about Nimrod, some connected with Abraham. The book of Jasher says Nimrod lived for 215 years and was killed by Esau, the grandson of Abraham. Jasher 27:1-16. Naram-Sin began to reign in the genealogy in 2203 BCE. 3 years after Abraham's birth, and with the similarity to what is said of Nimrod of his name and accomplishments, he may be seen as a test of the later Nimrod of tradition. Yes, so there seemed to have been more than one Nimrod, because it was like a name that was passed on. It meant hero or great one or rebel or whatever. So it continues as like a title, like king or something like that. But the Egyptian name Narmer resembles the Hebrew leopard. Jeremiah 13:23 says, "Can a Cushite change his skin or a leopard his spots?" Leopard in Hebrew is Namer. The Strong's number for Namer is H5246. Strong gives Nimrod as number H5248, while Rod is near H7291. There are Hebrew words radaf, meaning to hunt, as well as radad, meaning to conquer, and rada, meaning to reign, showing Nimrod as hunter or as a king. Leopards are depicted with serpent necks interlocked so as to form a circle on the Narmer palette, a claimed eclipse. And we are the ones that claimed it was an eclipse, speaking for us, because I don't really know who else claims that that Narmer palette depicts an eclipse, although I believe there were others who claimed that. Nimrod is held from some tradition to be born December 25th. Erech or Unug on the Sumerian king list may be that city built by Cain before the flood, named after his son Enoch. So Unug and Enoch and Erech could all be one word, similar names. Eridu, where Enmerkar built a temple. And there we go. Enmerkar could have been Nimrod, as we see the NMR consonants in the name Enmerkar, so that the temple Enmerkar built could be the Tower of Babel, or what was built by Nimrod after the confusion that stopped the construction of the tower. But it was built at Eridu, and that is the possible place of the Tower of Babel. And Eridu is said to have been the first pre-flood city, in other words, the first city of any kind. Compare with Eridu, and compare the word Eridu, that is, with the word in German, Erde, exactly the same consonants, E-R-D, and the word Earth in English, of course, is what Erde in German means. So this Eridu really means the beginning of the world or the Earth, right? It's the first city of all time. Where else to stop peoples scattering than the first city? Because we know that Enmerkar tried to stop the confusion of the language after it occurred, and tried to stop the scattering of the peoples by his letter that he wrote to the Lord of Arata, as we mentioned before. So if we go back searching for the name Enmerkar, he wrote to the Lord of Arata, Hake, wanting to restore one true language, as we mentioned there in paragraph 2 and 8. That seems like wasn't that long ago, but that's quite a ways back in our study, isn't it? That's it for today's study of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. And see if we have time for... Yes, I think we do. But I accidentally modified this. Hang on. We're starting to do part 7 of the part 2 of the movie Ra Expedition from 1972, The Adventures of Thor Heyerdahl. So this is part 2-7 of our examination of this movie, The Ra Expeditions, part 2.
The tiller of the unbroken starboard rudder can still be reached with the right hand, but the short fragment of the broken port side oar has to be pulled one way with a long bamboo rod and the other way by stepping on a rope, because the stunted shaft doesn't reach further than floor level, and there is still half the Atlantic to go. Thank you.
or deck had been pressed right down to sea level, as all our papyrus had become soaked from above as well as from below. The water which had tumbled over us unprotected sides in the days we drifted sideways without steering control had been absorbed above the waterline. This added weight pressed even our upper side rolls partly underwater. We were riding terribly low. Yet we were tremendously impressed to find that not a single papyrus reed had broken or come loose, and our thin spiral rope was entirely undamaged after the battle with the seas. Flexibility and toughness of reeds and ropes had saved our lives, whereas we had seen giant timber loose in the battle with the ocean.
To get some sort of shelter from the waves, they cut up their spare sails. Strips of canvas help protect them from breaking seas. To simplify the cumbersome steering, Heyerdahl suggests tilting the mast forward. This brings the sail right up into the bow. Because the sail is so far forward, it tangles with the papyrus bow, which they have to hack off. But with the sail pulling in front of the ship, they find it easy to keep their stern against the wind and waves. This is all that is needed to keep them on course, because the trade winds at their back always blow towards America.
You see them?
They learn one day from the radio receiver that a United Nations research vessel is trying to find them.
Ah, there they are. Right dead astern. I really see them. They're coming right dead smack behind us astern. You see them on the other way? Huh? Look, dead astern.
Oh, yes, I see it. Right. Yes. I don't understand that. I thought that was not yet.
It is the Calamar from the West Indies.
That's it then for today's study or viewing of the Raw Expeditions 1972 movie. Part two, that is, from YouTube. From the channel, the Kon-Tiki Museum. But what I want to get to now is talk a little bit about the other things that are happening. I'm trying to think what else there is now besides the leather. But the leather is something that I just Oh, yeah, I made a belt. That's what it was. That's the other thing. I just received a package of new leather that came all the way from California, Santa Ana, California. I think that's where it came from. Santa Ana, is that right? Or is it Anna, something else? I think it was Santa Ana. But now, let's make this video bigger. Right? Let's see, we got transition, we got make it bigger than that. Let's see, we got this bigger like that. There. So, look at the quality of this, the video quality. It's so much better in low light because I have the smaller image sensor, right? The smaller number of pixels. That's the key to that. But look at this belt. This is my fourth belt that I've ever made. Made it with the dark brown leather. Veggie tan, which smells really nice. It's the typical smell you get, with which you might be familiar about with to do with leather, that there's this smell about leather. It's the veggie tan. It's not the smell of the leather so much as the tanning method. But I've ordered some more leathers now because I just found it. The Lipsky leather is available, which is a chrome tanned leather. It's available in more colors than I'd found before. Much more widths and colors, and delivered the next day and all sorts of... Whereas I can't get this in many different widths unless I have it shipped from California. It takes many days to come. But this was when I got... Unless I buy the 1 3/4, which this was before I cut it down to 1.5 inch, and that I can get the next day in the brown and black. But I wasn't able to get it's an orange brown, I guess it would be just better to call it by what it is. This orange brown color, which came in the mail, that is a piece that's 2 3/4 wide, so I can get either 2 1 3/8 wide from it, or 1.5 and 1 1/4 or whatever. Quite some options for getting some belts from that piece. And then there's a black inside of it. Coiled up inside is the black, same width, same length. It looks a lot. Should be the same length, but no, that doesn't look right. Wait a minute, why is it? It's far more coils, but that's because the radius, you know, is a lot smaller. That they both should be the same length, but the one on the inside is many more coils because it's a smaller diameter, right? But shouldn't be that different, though, I don't think. But these are supposed to be, well, they can vary in length from 50 to 60 inches because they're made from real bull hides, which is not true of the Lipsky, it's cowhide. But bullhide, that's what this is. So I made this belt, and it's got this super great buckle, I think. Itchy nose because of the allergy season. This buckle is so great because it has its own keeper built in, right? Like, that's the beauty of these buckles that have a central post. Is it called a central post? I forget. The central... cross member, right? A central member here enables you to mount it so that the buckle becomes its own keeper. And you can keep the belt in place like that without installing any other kind of keeper. So that's the advantage of this style of buckle. And I have one that's in a bronze or a brass color. It's a brass color, but I think this is actually solid brass. It's a great deal, a great price for about $10 for the buckle. The leather itself costs about $30, but I got an extra 1/4 inch strip from this also. So a belt costs about $44 with all the hardware or whatever. Excluding the cost of the tools to make it, of course. Once you have the tools to make it, which basically are a sharp knife and a hole punch to punch the holes and thing, and you need the Chicago, I use Chicago Chicago screws on the back, right? I use Chicago screws. I want to make a snap belt. I might want to make this, convert this into a snap belt, or I might just leave this as it is. But I made a lot of little errors while I'm making this belt, like, as always, you know, every little thing you do, if it scratches the leather, you can see that. And there, but, you know, I like to use natural products and work with something like leather. It's just such a pleasure to do it. That's why I enjoy making belts so much, and I think I'll make a few more because I've got more leather on the way, and I've got leather here now with the different colors. And by the way, in addition to those two colors, the black and the orange brown, I also got more of this dark brown, which is 4 inches wide, which can enable me to make 3 different belts with this, either a 1 inch and 2 1.5s. So I mean, this is more of this exact same leather that I just. They both came. They all came in one package, right? That one was inside, in the middle of the package, wrapped in a very tight roll. But this is the same color as that, so I can make more of these belts. The question is going to be more about whether I want to make them with snaps or with Chicago screws to hold them together. The snaps have the advantage of, and I've ordered some new snaps that are supposed to be better for thicker leather. This is very thick. By the way, that orange leather is only 3.5 millimeters. This brown and the black are 4.5 millimeters thick, which is, it's not supposed to be that thick. It's thicker than what they specified. 3.5 really is what they specify it as from this leather from California. It's Sapeci. It's Italian leather, really. That's the other thing. It comes from California, but this is Italian leather from bulls' hides, bull hides. The bull hide, not cow hides. And it's so thick, that, and except for the orange brown, which is 3.5 millimeters, which is probably going to be more useful to put snaps in it, easier to put the snaps in without having to drill down into the leather to get the leather thin enough. And I've decided I'm going to use a Forstner bit, I think, to make the thinning out of any thinning I have to do to make the snap take hold in the leather. I've tried putting the snaps that I already bought into the thick leather, and it doesn't work very well. I mean, I needed to thin it out a bit, and even then I haven't been able to get it to bind very well. So I've got some more snaps coming that are brass colored, and the snap color probably doesn't matter, but I've got, I think there's only 10 sets of them, so I have to be good with it, or I'll have to order more. But that's it. If I spoil any of them, I'll have to order more. But it's October 2nd, 2024 of the Common Era. Little children, thank you for listening and watching. The time is 20:48 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now. And that was paragraph 5. Was it not? Of the Ark of Urartu, Chapter 3. Is that true? I just want to confirm this. Yeah. Chapter 3, Paragraph 5, the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. Okay. Very good. Bye for now.